Morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. May it please the court, Brian Rostocki appearing on behalf of Transamerica Corporation. I'd like to introduce my colleagues at counsel's table, Jim Martin and Colin Rabley.
Welcome.
Mr. Martin's been admitted pro hoc vice for purposes of this appeal and will be presenting today's argument on behalf of Transamerica.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, James Martin for Transamerica. With the court's permission, I've reserved 5 minutes for my rebuttal. As the court knows from the briefing, there are two principal issues raised in this appeal. The first concerns the enforceability of the judgment from Nigeria, and our attack there is based on lack of service of process and no applicable exceptions to that, meaning that there was no in personam jurisdiction over Transamerica for purposes of the Nigerian action, and meaning that under the Uniform Judgment Enforcement Statute, the judgment can't be enforced. Alternately, as the court knows, we have arguments concerning the construction of judgment, a legal issue for this court reviewed de novo. And those arguments provide that the award of prejudgment interest by the court was improper given the language of the Nigerian judgment, and further that the award of damages for purposes of conspiracy or for purposes of breach of constructive trust was duplicative and improper, again, construing the language of the judgment.
Now, on the service issue, the record reflects there's some affidavits and then at least one person has died. Is your argument that if everything's true, it's insufficient as a matter of law, or that the evidence of service was not credible, or a combination of both?
It's actually a little bit different than both of those points, Your Honor, because the evidence that the court is referring to relates to the first and original state action that was filed in the wrong court that did not have subject matter jurisdiction. That judgment was vacated as null and void. A de novo proceeding was ordered, and that proceeding began in a second court, the federal court, which did have subject matter jurisdiction, and the attack on service is related to that court. There, attempted service by mail to Transamerica was ineffective for the reasons that we've outlined in our brief. And with that service failing, the court acquired no jurisdiction over Transamerica in that second action. Now, the affidavits, et cetera, as far as service in the first action is concerned, even if the court were to consider that it was effective, it would be both a violation of Delaware law and due process of law to take the service in a 14-year-old action for a court that didn't have jurisdiction and was presiding over different claims and use that as a proxy to create in personam jurisdiction in a second action begun 14 years later. So that's the service of process.
Delaware has a statute that if you file in the Court of Chancery, which lacks jurisdiction, the matter can be transferred to the Superior Court, for example. And under that circumstance, there's no requirement to do service all over again. It's the original service that carries over.
In this particular case, Your Honor, the only substantiation that service would carry over comes from a declaration by Mr. Sanyulo, which is unfounded and not supported under Nigerian law and should not, as we've outlined in the brief, be credited by the court. So,
Was there a reference in the briefs that your own expert agreed with that?
There was a reference in the brief, Your Honor, but if the court looks at that reference, you'll find that it doesn't align with what is stated at that point. Our expert said two things in his affidavit. One was that there wasn't a new cause of action, and the rest of his affidavit related to service, and when the court reviews that affidavit, you'll see that he was adamant that Transamerica was not properly served in the federal action. Service was never affected, and the court didn't acquire jurisdiction. So he didn't agree with that piece of it, and his views align very much with the ones that we've taken under U.S. law. The second thing—
I think Justice Ridgely's point, at least as I understood it, was the reference to transfer from the High Court or the Supreme Court to the High Court in the federal jurisdiction in Nigeria the use of the word transfer, does it mean the same thing as it does in Delaware, which would obviate, at least under Delaware law, the need for a second service of process?
Right. At that point in the judgment where the court used the word transfer, it also said for purposes of rehearing. And so the transfer here meant something very, very different, particularly in light of what the express the court had to say about the actual proceedings themselves, which way they were null and void, and it wanted a de novo proceeding to start over. So it wasn't a simple transfer. It was a transfer for purposes of rehearing de novo with the prior proceedings being null and void. The example that I would point to, Your Honor, from our own experience.
Well, the proceedings that ordered the transfer weren't null and void. It was the court that they reviewed proceedings of null and void, correct?
Right, but the transfer.
And your client was on notice of the transfer, weren't they?
There's no indication of that in the record, Your Honor.
Did they participate in no way in the proceeding in the Supreme Court?
They participated by filing an affidavit, Your Honor, that preceded the judgment of the Supreme Court. But after that, the record is devoid of any indication of Transamerica's direct participation in the proceedings.
So there was a judgment against them in the High Court of the State of Lagos, which was obviated on the basis it was null and void. They didn't participate in that appeal?
They participated in the first appeal. There's evidence that Transamerica was represented by counsel in the first appeal. In the Supreme Court proceeding, which the court was referring to, the only thing that Transamerica did in connection with that proceeding was furnish an affidavit from Mr. Riley that said there was no jurisdiction over Transamerica in the court. After that, the record is devoid of any evidence that Transamerica affirmatively appeared in any of these proceedings relative in particular to the federal court.
Okay, that's a good turn of phrase, affirmatively appeared. Can you reconcile for me the distinction in 4805 and 4804 between notice of the proceedings and personal jurisdiction?
4804, if there's no in personam jurisdiction, that's a mandatory ground for rejection of the enforcement of the judgment. If there is adequate notice of the proceeding, then that can be a discretionary ground to continue to enforce under 4805. Here, as far as the federal action is concerned, there is no indication of either adequate service or notice in the record as it relates to an appearance by Transamerica on the merits or active involvement in the proceeding. Under those circumstances.
Well, that's why I asked the question. You go back to appearance. Is your premise that in order for there to be adequate notice, the party had to have entered an appearance?
The premise of the argument on adequate notice would stop a little bit short of an appearance, but notice has to relate to the ongoing proceedings in the action that we're attacking jurisdiction over. And with respect to the federal action, as I said, there's no indication of notice of Transamerica through service or otherwise that is directly related to its specific awareness of that proceeding. And so there's no, with that notice and lack of notice, excuse me, what happens is that the service then is ineffective, and that takes us back to 4804A, which is the mandatory ground for rejection of jurisdiction.
Does the record reflect how the documents, which the other side says were served at the Oakland, got into the Transamerica file, including the envelope?
The record does not reflect that, and it certainly doesn't reflect it in terms that would show service on Transamerica. The record is devoid of any evidence as to how those documents came into our possession, and without service and evidence of adequate service, issues related to notice don't subsume the due process problem that the plaintiffs have.
I mean, isn't there a permissible inference that physical possession allows an inference that there was delivery by someone?
We have cited two cases, Grand Entertainment and Universal Trading, that would establish that the awareness of attempts at ineffective service don't equate with proper service for purposes of in personam jurisdiction and don't meet the requirements for due process.
Well, my question relates to the fact that there's actual possession of the original service process document. Doesn't that allow an inference that there was service?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It allows for an inference that the documents were in our possession. It doesn't say how they got there, and manifestly, it doesn't say that they got there by proper service of process.
How else would they get there?
They could have gotten there by mailing from somebody outside of the context of the service. If they were left at Transamerica in Oakland, not properly served, as we've established, and eventually sent to Transamerica after that, that's inference is equally plausible on this record, and it would not show service of process.
What's the import of 4805A5? Did TIA have an office in the jurisdiction?
Not a business office in the sense that the statute requires, Your Honor. The evidence only shows transitory movement by TIA people at the Diula Hotel, which was a residential hotel, not a place of business. There's no affirmative testimony in this record that relates to business operations being conducted there, and no one said that Transamerica had a business office there. The closest you get is a couple of affidavits that said there was a base of operations.
What was the vice chancellor's finding in that respect?
The vice chancellor construed the base of operations testimony as being equatable with a business office, but that's a legal issue for this court. And the fact of the matter is the testimony regarding a base of operations doesn't equate with a specific business location with bricks and mortar and inventory and sales, the kind of things that the cases talk about in terms of what a business office actually is. The reason it rises to that level, Your Honors, is we're talking about a substitute here to equate with in personam jurisdiction. And the transitory presence of our employees for several months in the Diula Hotel is not the kind of presence that's associated with sufficient contacts or presence for in personam jurisdiction. So we run into the same due process problem on all of the exceptions that we do with the service itself. With the court's permission, I'd like to turn to the prejudgment interest issue and the damages issue, if I could. Even if service was affected here, the prejudgment interest construct by the district court is in error and fundamentally in error.
The district court or the court of chancery?
I'm sorry, the court of chancery, my mistake. It is in error because the court misperceived what the judgment said on its face. The claim in the judgment asked for 18% interest from September 3, 1976, or whatever rate of interest or time period the court would award. The court specifically responded to that in its judgment and awarded 5% interest for a time period from the date of the judgment. The court was very specific in responding to the claims that were made. There's no ambiguity about it. And the qualification overtakes any ability to recover the 18%, which wasn't mentioned at all. The specificity of the response, the plaintiffs say, is incongruous because of the amount of lapse of time here that went on, and so prejudgment interest must have been anticipated and expected. However, what the court was trying to do was replicate what would have happened in this action had it been timely filed in the right court and prosecuted expeditiously. It wasn't. So the court, in effect, awarded the rate of interest that aligned with that. That's a perfectly rational reason to do it. The same plain language problem exists with the conspiracy damages, Your Honor. The plaintiff's complaint and claim is very specific. Paragraph 30 of the complaint claim is the only one that relates to conspiracy. It only talks about defendants 1, 2, and 3, and not Transamerica. The Fourth Amendment defendant specifically is not mentioned in the only place that conspiracy comes into the complaint. When we get around to the relief sought, the complaint divides itself very specifically again between the three defendants who are subject to the conspiracy count where the damages are claimed in the alternative and Transamerica, where the damages are only claimed relative to breach of contract and breach of trust. Again, this court's de novo review of the plain language of that judgment cannot sustain an award of damages on that conspiracy count. And keep in mind that the judgment only awarded what was asked for in the claim. So it's perfectly, again, rational for saying that that conspiracy award doesn't apply to Transamerica. Now, the other construction point we have on these damages relates to the issues of constructive trust and conspiracy, again, being duplicative and in violation of Nigeria's accepted proposition against double recovery. Here, in construing the judgment consistent with Nigerian law, as the Uniform Act would require, you simply can't get additional tort damages for the same breach of contract for which you have received specific damages already in the award.
And that's what about for fraud?
Transamerica was not sued on the fraud count, and it's not part of the fraud verdict. We're only dealing with breach of contract, and as we analyze the claim, the constructive trust issue. The breach of contract, of course, and the violation of the commission agreement is the only specified wrongdoing anywhere in the complaint. The plaintiff got $255,000 for that purported breach, and in those circumstances, that's a full and sufficient award. Adding conspiracy allegations to that breach or saying that those damages are the raise of a constructive trust, it doesn't provide for additional damages, and providing for those additional damages, again, is in conflict with Nigerian law.
I thought I followed you to your last sentence. Did the vice chancellor simply transpose the numbers when he made an award or affirmed an award against TIA for conspiracy to breach the contract?
No, I think he awarded damages independently for that in the amount of 8 million naira. It wasn't a transposed number. The $255,000 number was the special damages that were awarded for the breach of the commission agreement, if I understood the court's question. Back to service of process for 1 minute, Your Honors. And on this jurisdictional issue that we talked about, I think the proper analysis on the subject matter jurisdiction question would be something that proceeds like this. I file a complaint in state court that is, in truth and in fact, a federal securities law action. The case gets dismissed at the state court trial level. It goes to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal declares that there is no subject matter jurisdiction over this action and it belongs in federal court. Under those circumstances, were I to walk across the street to the federal court with my new complaint, with new claims that reflect the federal securities issue, I, of course, would be required to reserve that on the defendant. And this transfer within the Nigerian system is analogous to that. That is why the court said null and void. That's why it said trial de novo. And that's why the transfer was for purposes of a rehearing. In those circumstances, the service 14 years earlier in the wrong court with different claims that had no subject matter jurisdiction can't, consistent with due process, be a proxy for not affecting proper service 14 years later in a different court that does have subject matter jurisdiction. That's the essence of our argument. And as to that federal action, there is no affirmative evidence establishing effective service on Transamerica, and second, no evidence showing that we appeared in the case, that we sought any affirmative relief on the merits, or that we did anything else that would provide for one of the exceptions in 4805 being present, including not having evidence in this record of a business office. So, with no in personam jurisdiction by virtue of the lack of service and with none of the exceptions applicable, you have grounds for mandatory non-enforcement, and that is true whether or not we actually had notice of the proceedings in some fashion, because as our briefing makes clear, notice or awareness of the proceedings is not a substitute for proper and effective service. The Grand Entertainment case, the Universal Trading case make that clear, and without effective service, no in personam jurisdiction. It's a due process violation to enforce the judgment. I will save the rest of my time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Just to make sure you understand, the rest of your time is 9 seconds.
Oh, is that all?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the Court. George Seitz for the appellee and cross-appellant, Chief Harry Akande. I'd like to begin with some comments on this cross-appeal that we filed first. In a typical case, we would have taken the judgment that was obtained in Nigeria and under the Uniform Foreign Judgment Enforcement Act, filed that piece of paper with the personatory, and if the judgment debtor had some issues about it, there would have been a resolution of the same questions under the Uniform Foreign Money Judgment Act. This was not a typical case. We could not enforce a judgment against Trans International Airlines, TIA, because it no longer existed. For that reason, we were dealing with a dissolved Delaware corporation, and that brought us to the Court of Chancery. Contrary to the contentions of my Transamerica, citing distinguishable cases dealing with preemption statutes in the tax court or specific versus generalist cheat statutes, or when a general controls a specific statute, or what the Delaware legislator is presumed to know when it passes a law, we think that the Uniform Foreign Money Judgment Enforcement Act and the Delaware General Corporation Law act sort of together, and they establish a means by which a judgment creditor can use the Delaware Section 263 to enforce his claim against a parent corporation who's dissolved a subsidiary. And in this case, we found, although it wasn't until the final day of discovery, and probably 4 or 5 years after my client had begun his efforts to collect on this judgment, that this company had adopted a dissolution plan by simply agreeing to assume the liabilities of its subsidiary. So we had a two-step process. First, we had to establish the judgment was enforceable. Then we had to establish that it was a valid debt of the subsidiary and that this company had assumed it. And that's, in fact, what the court did here. But we got into this case, and it was a little unusual because while we felt we had just a clear understanding of what had happened, had an assumption agreement, it had been breached, and we were entitled to damages. One of those damages was payment of the debt. But we felt under this particular case that, we felt in 2007 that we'd won the case, we'd gotten summary judgment. And it wasn't until after basically all the motions and all the briefing that we learned for the first time that they were going to dispute that there was no money judgment at all and there was no interest at all, not even post-judgment interest, which they're agreeing to now. So this was in 2007 in June, and we then began to figure that, well, this pre-judgment per annum, although we had believed under Nigerian law that that was compounded interest, we learned that it might not be, and we were looking for ways that we could have my client collect his opportunity cost. And we felt like under 263, which is a statute that says the court can impose any order that justice requires in a dissolution proceeding, that we could make an argument that, well, Judge, you have the power under this section to award additional damages in the form of opportunity costs. In the subsequent opinion, the court simply said it couldn't go beyond the Uniform Foreign Money Judgment Recognition Act. Now, we believe that under Delaware law and under 263, and I knew whatever panel sat here today, my knowledge of the Delaware corporation law would be dwarfed. And I felt like, well, I went to Bilotti, and I said, he's got to have the cases under 263. Well, there are no cases under 263. In his trees, there's 4 cases cited, and they really have no application to this situation at all. So when my friends say, he doesn't have any cases, they're right. There are no cases. But I think it's a simple process to go from, this is a valid judgment, they breached the contract, we're entitled to damages, And the court at least has the power to open the door. It doesn't have to award opportunity costs, but it can open the door for a hearing to look at the equity of the situation. And in my almost 40 years of experience in Chancery Court, what they did with their experts, I have never encountered. It was unbelievable, and it's in the record. And they try to argue equity on this issue, but equity doesn't have any place in this hearing today. It may in the future if the court says you can go back and seek opportunity costs. But if we have to go back on that, I'll be glad to. But I think under the Delaware General Corporation law, there is room under 263 to say to the judge, you don't have to award opportunity costs, but you do have that power. And if you want to open that door and look at it, you can. And that's all we're asking. Now,
but you admit that you're in the Court of Chancery because of this status of the dissolved subsidiary, and you're trying to enforce this foreign judgment. And now you want to expand the jurisdiction of the Court of Chancery to consider giving you relief on a separate claim that was never raised in Nigeria in the first place. Is that correct?
That's true, because the claim arose in a later time, after they had assumed liabilities and entered a contract and then breached it.
So if your theory is correct, we can assume hypothetically that even if the breach of contract judgment was paid and gone, that you have this entirely separate cause of action that you would be entitled to bring in the Court of Chancery independently.
If it was a valid debt of a corporation that they had not paid, we would have to have that as a precursor.
The two are interrelated.
Then. Yes, yes.
But you're still asking for relief in the Court of Chancery that was never requested in Nigeria when the monetary judgment you're trying to enforce was entered.
That's correct. Because if we were in Superior Court, if we were just limited to the judgment, they would be right. But we're not in Superior Court. We're in Court of Chancery. We have a breach of contract. It's a separate issue. Delaware law provides that corporations have to enter dissolution plans and provide for their creditors. And they didn't provide here. And so I think the court can consider all these issues and determine whether the award of opportunity costs would be appropriate. Because what my client here has here, all this 30 years of simple interest, in no way gives him what he would have if he had had this money back in 1976, 78. Now, on the issue of enforcement, I think the main flaw with the argument of Transamerica is that you don't have to prove service at all under the law of Nigeria to have a valid judgment. That's not what the cases say. They say, Vice Chancellor Parsons held in his opinion, in certain circumstances that plainly would satisfy minimum contacts jurisdictional requirements, the Uniform Foreign Money Judgment Recognition Act authorizes recognition of foreign judgments even if the foreign court technically may have lacked personal jurisdiction over the defendant according to its own law. Certainly under the laws of Delaware, the existence of circumstances identified in Section 4805 of the Act would support exercise of personal jurisdiction over the defendant. And then he cites the Camtech case, and there are other cases that we've cited in our briefs that fall along the same line.
Well, what did he find under 4805 would justify a finding that was adequate personal jurisdiction?
I think the Vice Chancellor found that, number one, they were served in Nigeria personally. Two, they appeared in the Nigerian proceedings. And three, they operated a business office out of which this dispute arose.
I take it, Mr. Seitz, under the first two, you're referring to the state court action.
Well, we think the state court action and the federal court action are the same. That Nigeria, this is not like a situation of the state and federal courts in this country. They've tried to take the domestic law of this country or the Delaware law and apply it to Nigeria. That's not the case. There is in this record several things that establish that no new service was required in order to do what happened here. Number one, our own expert gave opinion to that effect. Their expert gave opinion to that effect. And if you look at the opinions.
And did they cite either case law or statute or some authority in Nigeria in support of those opinions?
Neither one did. That's true.
Well, does that mean that it can be considered or not?
I believe it. If you look at what their cases that they cite, I don't think they stand for the proposition that they're arguing. The court can consider all that testimony in terms of whether there is a sufficient evidence to find that there was no service required for the second case. And there's also evidence to find that they were served in the second case because those envelopes and those documents were exactly the documents and envelopes that constituted the service by mail out of Nigeria. And I think that there is evidence to support that. But I think that under this uniform, that even under the, I don't agree that there was a separate case, but even if there was, this would constitute enough under our concepts of due process to constitute a valid judgment under the Act. And if I cited on this point, one of the opinions that Justice Saniolo cited in support of his case, of his position, was a Nigerian Supreme Court case that shows how these cases track in the courts in Nigeria. And they show, I believe this is at our appendix B338. On that page, it's a Nigerian Supreme Court case, and it shows the case proceeded from the first court to the federal court, the same one that were involved here, and then to the Supreme Court. So the appeals in Nigeria go first from the lower courts to the federal appeals court to the Supreme Court. It's the same court system. It's not a separate court system. And that's just a false premise that they've taken here for the first time. It was not raised below. If it had been raised below, we would have easily been able to show that. But they've made this argument up, and it's wrong. And I think if you look at that case at page B338, you'll see that, yes, this is it says the appellant was dissatisfied with the ruling on jurisdiction and then appealed to the Court of Appeals. And that was from the federal court, same court that's involved here, to the Court of Appeals. And from the Court of Appeals, appeals go to the Supreme Court of Nigeria. So it's part of the same court system. They're not separate. But interest, the business office exception, they make an argument that there's no business office. And they don't even cite a case. And there are numerous cases to discuss this. But in their argument, they don't even cite a case on the business office exception. And clearly there's evidence of a business office.
You're talking about the hotel.
The hotel.
They operate, that the employees operated out of the hotel.
Right. And in the affidavit that we cited in support of that, I think it was the McCauley affidavit, he refers to a piece of paper, the summons, that was on the floor of their office. He didn't say room. He said office at the hotel. Now, it's an affidavit. They left it alone. They never talked to the guy, and they never deposed him. So the unrefuted evidence is that he said it was an office in Nigeria. In addition, they try to point to a deposition transcript, a portion of my client's testimony, and they say that he was talking about the Delahoula Hotel, and he wasn't. He was talking about another hotel. So the basis of the premise for their claim that there was no office is just false. It's clear that they operated there, and under the cases, that presence could constitute a business office. Now, they say
you mentioned a few minutes ago that you think this is the same case, and you were referring to comparison between the complaint initially filed and what was transferred, whatever that means under Nigerian law, from the Supreme Court to a federal court in Lagos.
Yes.
Why do you think it's the same case?
Because if we were dissatisfied with what happened in the federal court, we would have appealed to the Court of Appeals, and they would have appealed that to the Supreme Court of Nigeria. And it's part of the same court system. They are not separate courts. We are not dealing with a situation like the federal court in the United States and the state court system. It's part of the same court system. And in the record, there's evidence of that. By just looking at that opinion, it shows how the appeals flow. And the cases, if you look at the cases that aren't new come from the Supreme Court, they show that the appeals come from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court of Nigeria.
So you're making an analogy to a single system where someone in Delaware would say, you should have been in the family court instead of the superior court, or you should have been in chancery rather than superior. And you're making the analogy that in Nigeria, that if they said here, you should have been in federal court, not state court, they're talking about where you bring it within the same system. Is that correct?
Yes. And in addition, the opinion of Justice Saniolo that I think is supported is that if there is a question about service here, it's a question about service, and this is true of many of their arguments, it's a question about service that should have been raised in Nigeria long ago, not here in this court. In a lot of ways, they're trying to make a collateral attack on the judgment, and they're not permitted to do that. For example, when this court ruled on the conspiracy award, it's clear the judge said, I'm not going to look at Nigerian law. I'm going to look at what the judgment said, and it found that the judgment said two things, awarded two different damages. It was just a question of interpretation. It didn't rely on Nigerian law at all. And in the complaint, there is evidence of conspiracy being claimed. We argue in the complaint itself, it refers to conspiracy. If I could just have a second here.
Yeah, but is TIA one of the defendants accused of conspiring to breach the contract?
Yes.
What paragraph is that?
Paragraph 31, and this is at A73. So to their said conspiracy, those defendants wrongfully and procured, caused, and conspired with the fourth defendant to breach. So they did plead conspiracy, and it was awarded. And the court found
the fourth defendant was TIA?
Yes. And the court found that TIA was part of the conspiracy in the opinion. And then the court awarded damages for conspiracy. So it doesn't seem logical to say that when we pleaded it and that when a court awarded it, the court found there was a conspiracy, and then it awarded damages on the conspiracy. It didn't award them to us. I think that it did. And lastly, on the prejudgment interest, it's clear that by referring back to awarding all of the relief contained in paragraph 6, it would not have to make that reference if it wasn't awarding prejudgment interest. It could have just simply said, I'm going to award damages and together with interest, post-judgment interest at the legal rate from this day hereof. And what they said about the judge and what his intent was and about the time, if he should have had a quick judgment in Nigeria, that was all just out of the thin air. There's nothing in the record to support that. All we know is that this case took a long, long time to resolve. Judgment was entered. It was entered with interest, and we think it's clear from the language. If you read those two sections together, it has to be an award of prejudgment interest.
Well, let me ask you one question about your cross appeal. How would you characterize the Court of Chancery's ruling that it had no jurisdiction to give you this additional equitable relief, or that it was declining to give you the additional equitable relief even if it had jurisdiction?
I think it did not decline. I think it found itself limited to the purview of the Uniform Foreign Money Judgment Recognition Act. And under that act, it could go no further. And I agree with that. I don't disagree with one word of the court's opinion, but I think what it said is I can't go any further. In fact, in the opinion, it said if I could give this, I would because of the conduct of the defendant here. But it felt it couldn't go beyond that.
But did you make the argument to the court that you're making here? Did you say, yes, you can? Here's your statutory authority to go further?
Yes. And I cite that in my brief. It was raised in a letter that they wrote on, that was June of 2007, AR-27. We responded with a letter brief to the court raising this issue, and that was on September 27th, B-279. And then in our oral argument, and this is at AR-33, we got through all this argument about the judgment and enforceability, and we said, you know, lastly, Your Honor, if you decide you can't get prejudgment interest, you can award opportunity costs.
Thank you, Mr. Seitz. We'll give you 5 minutes to respond to the cross appeal since you really didn't address it, and technically what you say was time for a rebuttal, but we never got a chance to hear from you on the cross appeal. Well, I appreciate that. I alerted you to that earlier, so you wouldn't be embarrassed if you stood up and I cut you off. But
right.
I hadn't really focused on the fact that you never got a chance to address the cross appeal, and we all three of us would like to hear from you on that.
In terms of the cross appeal, two things. One is that in the court below, this claim was raised in passing in the briefing, as counsel mentions. However, once the court made its award and said it didn't have the jurisdiction to do it, there were no further proceedings in the trial court complaining about the ruling that was made. That argument was advanced for the first time here, and it's based on Corporations Code Sections 281 and 283. And the first point I'd make on the cross appeal is when you look at those code sections, on their face, they don't expand the jurisdiction of the Chancery Court in the manner that counsel suggests to award the opportunity costs as provided. Second, I think as the court concluded, and correctly so, its jurisdiction began with the judgment from Nigeria that was the subject of interpretation. It had the interest claim in it. The court directly addressed the interest claim made in the judgment, and I think, again, correctly concluded that that disposed of the issue of whether prejudgment interest was going to be available in any amount and in any fashion. As to the notion that there's some independent claim running around out there that would substantiate an extra recovery, you certainly can't get that out of the complaint that was filed in the Chancery Court. And more importantly, again, as I said, you can't draw it out of Corporations Code Sections 281 and 283. They don't provide an independent ground of equitable jurisdiction to expand a foreign judgment or the relief coming from a foreign judgment in this fashion. And they don't turn the presence of a dissolution agreement into an affirmative damage claim that wasn't pled and mentioned only in a letter brief. On the equitable side of this, the delays that occurred in Nigeria were not at Transamerica's doorstep. Transamerica didn't file the complaint in the wrong court. It didn't delay for 2.5 years after the Supreme Court decided the case to begin proceedings in the federal court. It didn't wait 2.5 years then after the federal judgment to contact Transamerica about recovery. It didn't begin the action in the wrong court in the United States to try to recover and then wait 16 months after that to come to Chancery Court and then another 5 months to begin proceedings here. The notion that this sort of delay ought to be laid at Transamerica's doorstep as a guise for these opportunity costs is simply not a proper part of equitable jurisdiction in any event, and the court, again, was right to say that it wouldn't issue. On the sanctions question, as to the delay that went along with that, that was only a few months, and it doesn't compare to the years that we're talking about in Nigeria. Equally importantly, that has been paid and resolved, and it's over and doesn't relate to the merits of this proceeding. If I could make one point in 9 seconds on the merits, it would be that paragraph 31 in the complaint doesn't expand the relief sought or change who the conspiracy relief was sought against, and the court made no finding of conspiracy as it related to the damage award against Transamerica. It awarded the relief as pled in the complaint, and the conspiracy claims in the body of the complaint and the relief did not include Transamerica, and that's where the judgment began and ended.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.